Thank you very much, Gina, for that introduction, and I'm very pleased to again be able to participate in CEDA's economic and political overview. In line with the theme of this morning's conference, I want to discuss a couple of issues that I think will have an important bearing on economic developments in Australia over the next year or so. The first of these is the general performance of the world economy, and in particular, the ongoing strength in global commodity prices. And the second issue is the continuing evidence of restraint in both consumption and borrowing by Australian households. And I'd also like to briefly talk about the RBA's forecasts, which it released just over a week ago in the Statement of Monetary Policy. When I spoke at this conference a year ago, the central forecast for the world economy was that it would grow by around 4% in 2010, and at the time, many forecasters were focusing on the downside risks. As you can see from this first chart, things turned out quite a lot better than this. Over 2010, the world economy is estimated to have grown by around 5%. And there have also been upward revisions to the forecast for 2011. The IMF is now forecasting that growth in both this year and next will continue to be above trend. Now, these recent outcomes have been better than expected, although there are significant downside risks remaining, not least because of the poor state of public finances in many of the advanced economies. Now, these downside risks can't be ignored, although the recent positive data, have led to a renewed focus on another risk, and that is a rise in global inflation pressures, particularly as commodity markets have increased very significantly over recent times. And as an illustration of this increase, you can see in this next chart the RBA's own index of commodity prices. It's at an all-time high, and it's risen by almost 50% over the past year. Now, this upward pressure on global commodity prices is occurring at a time when the conventional measures of global output gaps remain quite large. Many of the advanced economies continue to operate well below full capacity and have very high unemployment rates. These large output gaps means that there is little upward pressure on domestic costs and prices in most of the advanced economies, and core measures of inflation remain mostly still very low. In earlier episodes in which these advanced economies were operating well below capacity, there was typically general softness in commodity markets as the weak demand in the advanced economies weighed on prices. Yet on this occasion, this is not happening. Instead, we're experiencing the coexistence of very strong commodity prices and large output gaps in the advanced economies. Now, I think the most plausible explanation for this is the continuing shift of global economic weight to the emerging market economies, particularly those in Asia. While industrial production in the advanced economies remains below its 2008 peak, as you can see in this chart, industrial production in Asia has grown very, very strongly. And as a result, there's been very strong growth in global demand for resources. And similarly, with incomes rising very rapidly across the region for quite a few years, the demand for agricultural commodities has also been very, very strong. In trying to understand what's going on here, I think it's useful to put these recent developments in a longer-term context. This next chart shows an index of global food prices adjusted for changes in the overall price level in the global economy. And as you can see, it goes back to the beginning of the 20th century. If you look at that graph, it's pretty clear that the 1980s and the 1990s were a period of unusually low food prices around the world. According to this particular index, if you take the period from 82 to 2000, the average price of food was around 30% below the average over the previous 80 years. And as you can see here, the same general picture applies to base metals, and to a lesser extent it applies to the prices of iron ore and coal as well. Of course, more recently, this has all changed. The relative prices of food, of base metals, of iron ore, of coal, have all increased very significantly. And in the case of iron ore and coal, the current prices are now at very high levels compared to the historical averages. Now, as always, these movements in prices reflect the evolving balance of supply and demand in the global economy. During the 1980s and the 1990s, the low prices for many commodities led to reduced global investment in exploration and in mine development. And in parts of agriculture, the rate of technological progress slowed down considerably. And this is evident in this next chart. Growth in both global yields and the land area devoted to crops declined significantly in the 1980s and parts of the 1990s. In effect, the low global prices for a whole range of commodities during this period meant that the incentive to expand the productive capacity was diminished significantly. I think we saw a clear example of this in Australia when the level of mining investment in the late 1980s and for much of the 1990s was lower than it had been in previous decades, and certainly much lower than it is now. Now, as things have turned out, this period in which the supply side was being pushed out only slowly has been immediately followed by a period of very strong growth in global demand for resources, largely because of what's happening in Asia. As I've spoken about previously, the urbanisation and industrialisation of China is very resource intensive, particularly in the commodities that are used to make steel. In addition, the demand for protein globally has risen very rapidly, as average incomes in Asia have increased quickly. For many commodities, the global level of inventories is now quite low, and it would appear that we are currently operating on a relatively steep part of the global supply curve, and weather-related disruptions have added to the price pressures for some of these commodities. And looking forward, we can't be sure what the future will hold. Few of us predicted the transformational effects of China's emergence on the world economy. At the moment, though, there has been some response on the supply side to high commodity prices, and we've seen increased rates of investment in the resources sector. And here in Australia, I think we see this more clearly than perhaps any other country around the world. What is difficult to predict is the time frame over which this increase in global capacity will allow the world economy to again operate on a flatter part of the supply curve. I think if recent experience is anything to go by, this time may be actually some way off. What does seem clearer is that the world economy is going through a very significant change in relative prices, and that this change is likely to be quite persistent. In theory, a change of this sort need not be inflationary for the world, with monetary policy ensuring that the target rate of overall inflation is achieved. And even where a change in relative prices is accommodated by a step up in the overall level of prices, the result need not be ongoing inflation, particularly if inflation expectations don't rise. In practice, though, things are not always so easy. A complicating factor is the current change in relative prices is playing out over quite a few years, and there's quite a lot of uncertainty about how much of it will be reversed. It's also difficult for some prices to fall to offset those that are rising. And importantly, the change in relative prices is occurring against the backdrop of ongoing stimulatory monetary policy around the world, including in Asia. While in most countries, domestically sourced inflation pressures remain subdued, there's an important global element coming from capacity constraints in commodity markets. And at least for the time being, it would appear that the ability of the world to produce commodities is becoming a key constraint on non-inflationary growth for the global economy. As the Governor said last week in the parliamentary hearing, managing these price pressures in global commodity markets is shaping up as one of the major international economic issues of 2011. In Asia, the high food prices in particular have meant that headline inflation rates have risen, and there's been a lift of inflation expectations in quite a few countries. If these inflationary pressures were to intensify, a stronger policy response than seen to date would be required, and this would ultimately increase the risk of a subsequent sharp slowing in the Asian region and in the global economy. The second issue that I want to talk about is the restraint in consumer spending and borrowing. As many in the retail industry will attest, consumer spending has been very subdued in recent times, and you can see the effect of that in the household saving rate. While there are a whole host of measurement issues here, the current data show that the household saving rate has increased from a little below zero in the first half of the 2000s to around 10% in 2010. With the benefit of hindsight, a change in trend looks to have actually started in the middle of the 2000s, although at the time this change in trend was quite difficult to detect. Over the decade to the mid-2000s, there was a very large run-up in household debt and asset prices and a decline in the household saving rate, as you can see. This reflected households adjusting to lower nominal interest rates and the innovation in the financial system. And I think it's plausible to argue that this adjustment was, in fact, largely completed by the mid-2000s, and since then, household spending patterns have been returning towards more traditional norms. And over the past few years, this change has been reinforced by the global financial crisis, which has led many households to rethink their spending and borrowing decisions, partly in response to greater uncertainty about future asset returns. Now, a slightly different way of seeing this change in behaviour is to look at how much of the increase in household incomes each year is actually spent. As I hope is evident from this chart, in quite a few of the years during the decade and a half to the mid-2000s, household consumption increased by more than $1 for every extra dollar of income that was received. In contrast, since 2005, only around 65 cents in every extra dollar of disposable income has been spent. It seems reasonably clear now that after a long period of structural adjustment to lower interest rates and financial innovation, many households are putting more aside each month than they were for most of the 1990s and in the early 2000s. Now, this change in behaviour can also be seen in a range of other indicators. One example is the disaggregated data available through the annual Hilda Survey of Household Finances. In the surveys that were undertaken between 2000 and 2005, there was a clear trend, with fewer and fewer households with mortgages reporting that they are ahead of schedule in their repayments. You can see that on the right-hand side there. This downward trend slowed around 2005, and then in 2009, which is the most recent year for which we have data, there was a marked increase in the share of people reporting that they were ahead of schedule. Similarly, over the past couple of years, as you can see in the other panel in this graph, there's been an increase in the proportion of households who report that they pay their credit card off in full every month. This change in behaviour is also evident in responses to the survey conducted by the Melbourne Institute and Westpac. In particular, over recent years, there's been a marked increase in the number of households that say paying down debt or building up bank deposits is the wisest thing to do with their savings, and correspondingly, there's been a decline in the number of households that say investing in stocks and housing is the preferred investment strategy. A similar story is evident in estimates of how much equity the household sector is adding to the housing stock. As you can see in the top panel here, up until the late 1990s, it was common for the value of new investment in housing to significantly exceed the total amount of new housing-related borrowing. In effect, the household sector was building up equity in the housing stock. During the early part of the 2000s, this changed, and we went to a position in which the household sector was withdrawing equity from the housing stock. Over recent years, things have changed again, and we've returned to the more traditional pattern of injecting equity into housing. So taking all these indicators together, it seems pretty clear that something has changed in the behaviour of households. It's likely that part of this change reflects the completion of the structural adjustment to lower interest rates and changes in the financial system, but recently there also appears to have been a change in attitudes to spending. As we discussed in the Statement of Monetary Policy just over a week ago, an important factor shaping the outlook for the economy is how persistent this change in attitudes turns out to be. On the one hand, it is plausible that consumption growth again strengthens considerably over the next year or so, supported by strong income growth and an unemployment rate that's likely to be trending down. On the other hand, this more cautious approach to spending could actually be quite long-lasting, with households using the strong income growth to further improve their balance sheets. In putting together our forecasts, we've assumed a middle path, with the saving rate staying high, but consumption and income growing broadly in line with one another over the next couple of years. We will, of course, be looking very carefully as the data come in to see if this is how things are actually evolving. Before finishing with a brief summary of the forecast, I want to draw your attention to one issue or one side effect of the recent subdued growth in retail spending, and that's the downward pressure on the prices of many retail goods. As you can see from the bottom panel of this chart, over the past year, the ABS's price index for clothing has fallen by a bit over 6%. The price index for major household appliances has fallen by 4%. The price index for furniture and furnishings has fallen 1.5%. And the price index for audiovisual and computing equipment, which isn't shown here, has fallen by 18%. In fact, if you go through the CPI, there are very few non-food manufactured goods whose prices have actually increased over the past year. Now, these pervasive price declines follow the substantial appreciation of the exchange rate and the tariff cuts on a range of goods in the early part of last year. While it's difficult to be definitive, it's possible that the weak consumer spending has led to faster pass-through of the exchange rate changes than would be suggested by previous experience. And there's also been some moderation in inflation for goods and services whose prices are not directly influenced by the exchange rate, although the effects have been quite a lot smaller. And overall, over 2010, the consumer price index increased by 2.7%, and the underlying measures of inflation were around 2.25%. Now I'd like to finish by briefly turning to the bank's updated forecasts. As I suspect many of you know, our central scenario for the economy remains very positive, with the economy expected to go strongly over the next few years. However, the quarterly profile for GDP in the near term is going to be materially affected by the extreme weather events that we've seen recently. These events disrupted production in both the December and the March quarters, especially in the coal industry, and the bank's current estimate, which inevitably remains subject to significant qualifications, is that the total level or the level of output in the March quarter will be around 1 percentage point lower than it otherwise would have been. And given this effect arises mainly from a disruption to production, the decline in spending is likely to be somewhat smaller than this 1%. Following the March quarter, we expect a strong rebound in output as coal production recovers and the rebuilding effort gets underway. Over 2011, our current forecast is for the economy to grow by around 4.25%. This is higher than we were expecting 3 months ago, although the upward revision just reflects a lower starting point because of the decline in coal production in December last year. If we look beyond the current year, we continue to expect the economy to grow in the 3.75% to 4% range. The extreme weather events will also have a noticeable effect on the near-term outcomes for inflation. Since the S&P was released, we've been able to make a preliminary assessment of the likely effects of Cyclone Yasi, particularly on banana and fruit and vegetable prices. And the bank now expects CPI inflation to be around 3% over the year to June 2011, with the combined effects of the floods and the cyclone likely contributing around 0.5 percentage point to this outcome. This forecast represents an upward revision to the one we published a few weeks ago, largely because of the expected increase in banana prices. Of course, with the price of bananas likely to fall back to more normal levels later in the year as production recovers, there is a period during 2012 when the year-end inflation outcomes could be expected to be lower than those we published in the S&P. Looking through these weather-related effects, though, inflation is expected to gradually increase over the next couple of years to be around 3% in late 2012. As always, these forecasts are subject to a number of uncertainties, but as is our usual practice, we will continue to examine the ongoing flow of data on the global economy, on domestic spending, domestic production and prices, and assess whether the outcomes remain consistent with this broad positive outlook for the economy. As I said at the outset, two of the issues that we'll be watching particularly closely are the developments in global commodity markets and the attitudes of Australian consumers to spending and to borrowing. With that, thank you very much for your time.
Graham Hooper, Lake Macquarie City Council. Just be interested in your viewpoint on housing construction starts and the impact that they will have on the domestic economy.
Just recently we've seen a slight rise in housing loan approvals after they'd come down a lot after the expiration of the first homeowners grant. So I think we're going into a period of a gradual rise in home building. An issue that we've drawn attention to in the past is the need to significantly increase the rate of home building in the medium term, because if the population continues to grow at its current rate, which is quite fast, then we're going to need to build the houses and the apartments for the people to live in. And in the past 5 years, the average household size has been rising, and that is a reversal of a trend which has been going for at least 5 decades. It may be because of changes in preferences amongst households and the way people choose to live, but the relatively limited number of houses and apartments that are being built is part of the explanation. So I think that's a medium-term issue. In the short term, I think we're going into a gradual upswing.
Stephen Martin, Cedar. I was interested in one of the slides, Rob, that you produced. I think that's a composite of RBA work and other government agencies that showed the various investment projects that were in the pipeline, as it were, around Australia. And what I was taken by was the fact that the general view around Queensland and Western Australia being the principal drivers of economic benefit in Australia. If you look at that chart, in fact, there are quite a number of other projects in a number of other states. I wonder if both of you might like to comment about the size of those projects, the potential contribution that they would make to each of the states in Australia generally, and whether, in fact, the so-called 2, 3, 4, 5-speed economy that we keep hearing about may, in fact, not simply be represented by Queensland, Western Australia versus the rest around investment projects.
I think it's pretty clear that we're going into a period now where the level of investment in the country relative to GDP is going to be the highest in many, many decades. That means the capital stock is rising very quickly. It's particularly pronounced, as you say, in Queensland and Western Australia, but not restricted to those two states. The other thing that's going on is we've got a lot of capital investment, but the prices at which we are selling the Australian resources to the world are extraordinarily high. And that is generating a lot of domestic income. If the export prices now were around where they were the average for the 1990s, the per capita income, the real income, the spending power of our money would probably be between 15 and 18 percentage points lower than it currently is. So just the income effects are very, very large from the higher commodity prices. And on top of that, and income effects flow right through the economy, not just in Queensland and Western Australia. And on top of those income effects, we're getting a lot of investment in physical capital. But this is occurring at a time when the economy is operating fairly close to full capacity. The unemployment rate is, we're pretty close to full employment. Measures of capacity utilisation are around average. So there's not a lot of spare capacity in the economy. So if we're going to go through a period of very rapid increase in investment, which I think we are, then other parts of the economy are inevitably going to grow less quickly because it's not like there are a lot of spare resources that are there just waiting to be utilised. And the high exchange rate is part of the way that in our system, in our market-based system, the resource reallocation takes place. So there are parts of the tourism industry that are relatively soft, parts of the education sector, parts of manufacturing, parts of agriculture, where there is a resource reallocation going on, but it's inevitable in an economy which is having extremely rapid growth in the capital stock and the starting point is close to full capacity.
Nigel Lake from Pottinger. A question really about the more medium to long-term outlook and picking up on the comments you made there about the importance for this economy of countries such as China and the fact that we're really exposed very much to effectively marginal increases in demand for those countries and has a very leveraged effect here. At what point do you think action by countries such as China on things like climate change will have an impact on demand for Australian resources and how will that then flow through to this economy?
Well, I'm not an expert on Chinese climate change policy, but you know, I think there's a broader point here that China will, it's incredibly important to the Australian economy for the reasons we've talked about, and China will have a cycle. Now, I think if you take the next 20 years, I think China, it's not inconceivable they grow 8% on average over that period, but there are going to be ups and downs. And that is a big challenge for us to manage those ups and downs. We have to remain flexible. Having a floating exchange rate is obviously a very important part of that. Having flexibility on fiscal policy is very important. Having a flexible labour market. So the central scenario is good, but there are risks here, and we're going to need to manage those, and climate change may be one of them, and inflation in China and the authorities having to respond to the inflation and then slowing the economy by more than expected is another one as well. And there are a whole range of other risks that we could talk about, but we can't assume that this Chinese growth is going to be uninterrupted, and we need to prepare for that.